This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Our show originates from the Investar Tower building in Baton Rouge, and your number is 877-217-5757. Please send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. And in a bit, we'll talk about the events of the day politically, 13 weeks before the November 5th election, as of today, 91 days away from the finish line. And Vice President Kamala Harris has chosen Minnesota Governor Timothy James Walz as her running mate. Like Harris, he was born in 1964. He's a few months older. He just turned 60 in April. Former U.S. Congressman, 5 terms, and the governor of Minnesota as well for a couple of terms now. He was elected in 2019. So Tim Walz, who he will become now the most famous Minnesota politician in recent vintage since Jesse the Body Ventura, once a frequent guest on our show, and he follows in the footsteps as a Minnesota politician to be in the limelight as Hubert Humphrey, the pride of LSU, who is Vice President of the United States and a senator from that great state. And we will talk more about that in just a bit. But our weekly or monthly visit from Mary Stein of the Baton Rouge Library is in store. And coincidentally, perhaps not, there is a new library series coming this year in September and October pertaining to the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Obligations. Let's start there since we're talking politics, Mary.
Sure. Well, we wanted to cool the temperature a bit, and let's just take a step back from all the passion. And there's a wonderful book by author Richard Haass where he said, okay, we've got 10 rights, guaranteed these rights, but those rights come with obligations. And he broke it down into 10 obligations. LPB did a wonderful documentary on it in January called A Citizen's Guide to Preserving Democracy, and it just made such an effect on me that we've created our own program, and we're going to show the documentary, and we're going to talk about 2 of these obligations every week. And we're going to be using some local moderators to kind of help us craft our thinking, and it's the kind of series that you could just do yourself and follow along at home or come to the library and do it. So that's something that we're doing to try to help. Libraries all about preserving democracy and giving people an opportunity in a safe place to exchange ideas. So we're very excited about that. But there's so much more, Jim, so much more.
There you go. Well, we got a lot more to talk about, but this is a 5-part series. It starts in September, and I'm sure we will be talking about it next month with Mary. And again, your number is 877-217-5757. A development, and we've talked about it, Baton Rouge has a high rate of people with library cards, and right now, kids have 3 choices, don't they?
Right. According to our new law, Act 436, we had to go back and block about 160,000 cards and then give parents the opportunity to come in and freshen them up, re-update. And they could either choose the same card that they always had, and they can do that just by calling in, or if they wanted to have a more restricted card where a child could only check out books from the children's room, a teen could only check out from children and teen, and none of them could check out anything from the adult collection, that was the restricted version. And then there was an unrestricted version where even a child could check out a book from the adult collection with the proviso that we're not letting any child check out a restricted movie. So it's been very interesting to see that only 1.47% of our parents who are updating their children's cards are choosing the restricted cards. They are choosing the regular cards and the unrestricted cards. And with school starting soon, we're kind of glad to see that because we've already had to turn away high school kids from the adult collection and they weren't able to check out a World War II book, which I'm sure was not the intent of the law, but it was a consequence of it.
Are more people going for restricted or, unrestricted or regular?
It's a little bit more of the regular right now because of the ease since you can just call or press a button and keep that same piece of plastic. If you're going to get the unrestricted one, you're getting a new piece of plastic, so you have to be able to come in person. And so it's a little bit higher trending on the regular card, which was, you know, it wasn't broken. We didn't want to fix it, but there you have it. So that's happening. It's always great to have anybody update their library card because it gives them access to so much stuff. And some of the stuff is programmatic, like the DNA information. We're hosting the
August 17th.
Yes, coming 10
a.m.
Right,
so we're inside 2 weeks.
Yeah,
all day long, isn't it?
That's right. It's a symposium. We're not going to feed you lunch. We'll excuse you for lunch, but there's plenty of fabulous places to eat near the library. But it's going to be a whole day of forensic genealogy. It's so cool. If you're a true crime follower or you just are fascinated by the idea of finding a family member through DNA, that's the program for you. And then, of course, our signature program for the month is Alka Yoshi, flying in, live and in person, the author of The Henna Artist, The Perfumist of Paris, and The Secret Keeper of Jaipur.
So we've interviewed her a couple of times.
Well, her writing, we are, it's so foreign to us. So when you read her books, you really are going to walk a mile in someone's shoes and explore a culture and a time so different, because it's 50s India and then Paris. And I was blown away.
Mm-hmm.
I really was immersed in the culture when I read her books, and she's a delightful person to chat with. So we're really looking forward to her coming at the end of the month for a Saturday morning program at the main library. And of course, books
are everywhere.
That'll be
August 24th.
That's right.
10 a.m. Saturday, main library, and Alka will be here in person. So there'll be a Q&A to follow. And she is one of the top writers in the world in the DNA and genetic genealogy, which Mary alluded to. That's the week before, August 17th. And this is at the main library as well.
That's right. I'm kind of greedy. Keep them all to myself. But it's because I have the biggest room. And just for fun, come by the main library today. The symphony will be popping up under the grand stairs. It's symphony week. And they'll be
elsewhere.
They're
playing at the main library today. Huh?
Yeah, they are. And then they'll be, they were already at Baker and Delmont, and they were at River Center yesterday. So there'll be music popping up
all around.
What time
do they get started?
Noon. So get there a few minutes early to grab a seat.
So you can spend your lunch hour with the symphony at the main library on Goodwood.
Yeah.
Now, a listener asked, and I see it in your offering here in the latest issue of their fine magazine that the library puts out every month, The Source. There is an exhibit, The Illustrated History of Baton Rouge, going back to the 17th century. Tell us more.
So, of course, we've been working very hard to build up the Baton Rouge Room, the archives, special collections. Some of it's photography, some of it's realia, real, you know, objects that people have saved, found in their attic, found in a shoebox, and we're preserving those, we're identifying them, and then we're creating discovery tools so that researchers can also use them now and in the future. And of course, filmmakers, documentarians, newspaper reporters, magazine writers are always coming by the Baton Rouge Room to ask for information about Louisiana history, Baton Rouge history in particular. And they have a lovely illustrated history on display right now. They're going to be doing a program later in the month on a Wednesday night. They do their special lectures on Wednesdays. And this is going to be a lovely taste of what we have. There are over a million images in that collection. And it's untapped. It is really so cool.
And next Thursday night, 6 o'clock, once again, Main Library on Goodwood, the book from Press Robinson, Pressing Forward, will be unveiled. And that's next month. I'm sorry.
Yeah, next
I'm sorry.
Month.
I'm jumping the gun.
Right.
That's September 15th.
Right. So that's a save the date.
You can still go. You can still go.
Absolutely.
A week from Thursday, but it'll be next month. So
yeah.
Press Robinson. But I'm hearing great things about his book.
Yeah. We're excited
to
get
that.
All right.
Well, I'm sorry I jumped the gun.
No.
But you have many authors, and that's heady stuff getting Alka Yoshi. She is strong, and she, these are books, of course, that have had a national and international following. So the henna artist, I recall talking with her on this show about that, and her last one as well. So she is an amazing person, and she is a force of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't want to miss Alka Yoshi, Saturday, August 24th at 10 a.m. Evangeline, the musical in concert, that's coming soon as well, isn't it?
You know, there's bits and pieces of things at all 14 locations. I joked and said I like to keep the best stuff at Maine because that's where I am. But we really do try to scatter things all the way around. With Evangeline, mm-hmm. we're promoting something that's going on in town. So because we love our community and there's so much to do.
That's the 22nd through the 25th. And a mm-hmm. listener notes that August 15th, the date that I gave for press, is actually Rhythm and Blues Review.
Yes.
So that'll be...
At the Mansion.
Yeah, that'll be really something. So, Mary, keep up your great work. We'll talk again next month. And it's always a highlight to see and hear Mary Stein.
Thank
you. We're
you.
Back after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Sonny Cranch, veteran ad man and quite a man about town for many years, and he's been involved in films. We'll talk a bit about that. And he's an avid writer and explorer of humanity and history. And last week, William Kelly, one of the most infamous people in American history, died. He, many people probably didn't know, was still alive. But Sonny, you've been, along with John Hardy, I know, producing a play that I think will someday be available to the masses, and it's about the My Lai Massacre. And most people don't remember that March 16th, 1968, there was a mass murder of unarmed civilians in South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. At least 347 and up to 504 civilians, almost all women, children, and elderly men, were murdered by U.S. soldiers under the command of William Kelly. That's something that we've kind of wiped away from the history books, but I think we have to remember that we're not often, or not always, as Americans, without sin ourselves.
Well, it was a tragedy, no doubt, and the number of 504 is probably closer to the truth, and there were other areas, other My Lais, other hamlets that were attacked by other platoons in Company C, Charlie Company. Captain Ernest Medina was the company commander, and William Kelly was a platoon leader in his platoon.
Lieutenant Kelly Jr.
Right. He was not what you would call an overachiever. He ended up enlisting in the Army after he'd gotten his draft notice and started off as a clerk typist at some outpost up in Washington State, as I believe. And at that time, the military was kind of running low on junior officers, and they were running out of West Point grads and ROTC grads to fill these second and first lieutenant positions, platoon leaders, among other assignments, but and they were relying very much on their OCS, officer training schools. They used to call them 90-day wonders. Well, somehow Cali got into OCS and graduated at the bottom of his class.
He used to have to pass an IQ test to get. Had to make like a 120, which is a pretty good IQ.
Well, I don't think that was in World War II. This was definitely a measure of filling the ranks, as it were. So anyway, there was an area in Vietnam where intelligence had said there was a high concentration of Viet Cong and other Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, et cetera. And this was right after the Tet Offensive. And This area of Songmi Province contained a number of hamlets, of which there were several called My Lai. And on March 16th, as you just noted, 1968, the entire company was downloaded by helicopter into this area. And by the way, on the military maps, it was shaded in pink because of the expected concentration of Vietnam. So no one knew Song Mi or My Lai. They just called that area Pinkville. And Callie, leading the first platoon, went in and really to impress his captain, who had not thought too well of him up until that time, felt they needed to, and their orders were to, if it moved, kill it. And as a result of that, as you said, women with children in their arms.
They were raped as well.
Their homes were torched. Anything, you know, the Captain Medina had said, anybody who was in that village on that Saturday, if they weren't at market, they were Viet Cong. They were the enemy. Mm-hmm. And so at any rate, and one of the heroes of that, by the way.
We'll get to that. It's Hugh Thompson. Sure, Hugh Thompson, which is an amazing story. And our friend Trent Andrews wrote the book, Forgotten Hero. And it has a Louisiana connection. Who would have thought? But he was a hero. He was a hero. But Callie was 24, the leader of 1st Platoon and C Company. He was convicted of murdering 22 villagers, given a life sentence. He served 3.5 years under house arrest, and then U.S. President Richard Milhouse Nixon commuted his sentence. That guy should have been in jail forevermore, or executed.
Absolutely. Well, at least imprisoned, literally imprisoned. But he was not, and he stayed at Fort Benning, where his trial was conducted. Now, there were several others, Captain Medina and Colonel Barker, the head of the task force. All of these and others, you know, this whole thing was covered up. Mm-hmm. There was no record of it. And thankfully, to the Hugh Thompsons of the world, and another Louisiana connection, Ron Ridenour, who learned of this, who had trained with many of these people in 1st Platoon, and learned about the massacre later, and he ended up in New Orleans as an AP correspondent and died in New Orleans. But as Hugh Thompson will talk about, who's buried in Abbeville, I believe, who was the helicopter pilot. Mm-hmm. Hugh Thompson was flying a scout helicopter. And a little bubble, you know, scouting for enemy troops and locating enemy fire. And he flew over My Lai and saw what was happening. And he literally landed his helicopter and confronted Callie and said, "What are you doing? Why are you killing these civilians?" And Callie, being a second lieutenant, and outranked Hugh Thompson and said, "Mind your own business, get out." Thompson reported it, but there was no record of that report. And Ridenour found out from his fellow trainees who were literally on that mission about what happened. And wrote a letter that opened the entire investigation. So Ron Ridenour, supported by the testimony of Hugh Thompson, of what led to the court-martial of Rusty Callie.
Well, the massacre was originally reported as a battle against Viet Cong troops, covered up by the U.S. Army, and the efforts by Ron Ridenour and journalist Seymour Hersh
later
broke the news of the massacre. And
Hersh got it into public the public, but go ahead.
But the front page of the New York Times last Wednesday reads this way: William L. Callie Jr., who was a young Army lieutenant during the Vietnam War, was the only American convicted in the murder of hundreds of unarmed, unresisting Vietnamese civilians in the atrocity known as the My Lai Massacre, died on April 28th in Gainesville, Florida. He was 80. His death at a hospice was confirmed on Monday night by Social Security Administration records. The cause was not publicly disclosed. Family members did not respond to requests for more information. Mr. Callie's death was first reported by the Washington Post More than 50 years after the killings of as many as 500 women, children, and older men by Americans who attacked with automatic weapons, grenades, and bayonets, raped girls and women's, mutilated bodies, killed livestock, and burned the village.
Correct.
And to put this in perspective, it's March 16, 1968. 14 days later, Lyndon Johnson says, "I'm not running." This may have contributed to that. I think he was tortured by what was going on there, but he couldn't bring himself to get America out.
Well, yes, and by then the country was just so terribly divided, or one of the worst divisions as we're experiencing today, yeah. But it was terribly divided over anti-war. Yeah.
You're right.
Support the war.
And then on April 4th, just 19 days after Martin Luther King's assassinated mm-hmm. in Memphis. Mm-hmm. So for those who say we've never been through times like this, we have, yeah. And worse.
Exactly.
But it's a much more dangerous world now than it was then, and we have to be mindful of precautions, if there are any. But I hope we learned a lesson. Sonny Cranch will talk about that when we return after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Visiting a few more minutes with Sonny Cranch, who's really done Baton Rouge well for many years in many capacities. He once worked for Pat Screen, mayor, president of East Baton Rouge Parish, who Sonny and I admired him, and he was a man of immense talent with some demons that ultimately did him in. I think about him because we're coming up on 30 years since he died, mm-hmm. September 11, 1994, and he was only 51 years old, Sonny. What that man could have done if he had not had the demons is
well, certainly palatable. He was one of the most progressive mayors this city has ever seen. A lot was accomplished under his administration, everything from EMS to the riverfront. That whole development with the riverboat landing all the way through Catfish Town was... could be, noted as accomplishments under his administration. But he was, and sadly, we lost him. But
let's get to your project. You and John Hardy.
Well, I wanted to clarify that. John is certainly a party, but there are two other collaborators. Scott Kramer, who's out in L.A., who John connected me through. We all have the common connection of Steven Soderbergh, another little Baton Rouge boy who's done well. But Scott Kramer and Zach Godshaw. Zach is a screenwriter.
I know, he's been on our show.
Well, he is terrific. In fact, I met Zach when we did the screenplay for, we have a screenplay on Hugh Thompson, but that led to the development of this...
Pinkville,
a 10 episode. It's now 10 episodes. We probably have to get it down to 8, but it's a 10-episode, miniseries. And it basically addresses the very fact of... turn the page here, I have it. Pinkville is a true story about moral failure and moral courage, because once this came to light... The military stepped in, and they did everything they could to bring to justice those who were involved. Callie was the only one convicted.
And then Nixon let him off.
And let him off.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Scott Kramer and Zach Godshaw were collaborators on this. And hopefully it'll make it to a streaming service one of these days.
Oh,
it's come close, but then the after strike and COVID and everything else kind of...
Well, it has relevance, but Sonny does have a track record, and Robin Dow, who was born in the year of 1998, 9 years after Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Sonny, it's been 35 years since you and John Hardy and Steven Soderbergh.
Well, again, I got to go. John Hardy's,
house?
It was my house, but, I was doing what John told me to do. Here, Sonny, do this. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And I understood what they were doing, but Stephen, that was his first...
I know you no longer live at that house, but what's the address?
734 Woodview Court.
That's where Sex, Lies, and Video tape was.
Well, the primary residence, Andy McDowell.
Yeah,
and,
I know. That's where Peter Gallagher and
Peter,
Laura Sanchez.
That was their home, yeah. As it were. Yeah. And other locations around town.
Well, 35 years later, talk about something that's stood the test of time. That one's a classic.
Well, John, you know, John Hardy, my business partner, he's a graduate. We both worked together with Brooks Reed back in the 70s, mm-hmm. and we both quit. I started the company. He went to the London Film School, which and got what is mm-hmm. the equivalent of a master's degree in film production.
Well, that was Soderbergh's first film, wasn't it?
That was his first film.
That's not
John,
a bad way to start.
He came. He had a script. Some people liked it. John do a production breakdown. John, having his experience in education and film production, did the breakdown, mm-hmm. came up with a budget. They approved it, and that was going to be a video-only release originally. But
won at the Cannes Film Festival.
Well, first it won at the Sundance Film Festival. It got the Audience Choice Award. And they realized then that, wait, maybe this could be a theatrical release. And so...
And it was made for what, a million? A little
million
over?
Two, I believe, is
1.2
the budget.
Million. Yeah,
and I was not actively involved. We had a business to run. Right, John was doing the, he was the producer on this.
It was your bedroom, your living room, your kitchen, your dining room. It was all.
Bathroom.
All in
Sex, Lies, and
Videotape. And Robin Dow has pulled up the trailer. It's been a while since I've seen or heard this, but I think we'll get the idea. Peter Gallagher, James Spader, Andy McDowell, and Laura
San Giacomo.
There we go.
Correct. But
1980.
Yeah, that was interesting. It won Film Dance. Then they said, this can be theatrical. So all these distributors were bidding, and the winning bid, the best bid for a theatrical release was... Bob and Harvey Weinstein, Miramax Productions.
Isn't that something? Yeah, you had to bring him up, but he was involved too.
Well, they had the distribution rights, and he, through his connections, got it to the Cannes Film Festival, where it won the Palme d'Or. And I always joke, John, of course, went to to Cannes, and people asked me, did you? I said, no, but my tuxedo did.
All right. Can we pull it up, Robin, or can we not? I'm just curious. 35 years later, I remember seeing this at the Segan Theater.
A lot of women out there, they'd be glad to have a young, straight male making a pretty good living.
All right. I don't know where he's going with that, so Robin cut him off. But that was Peter Gallagher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Right. He was great. He was. He said that when they had the premiere in Los Angeles that. He needed an escort to get out of the theater because he played such a heel in that movie. but it is one that, if you like Baton Rouge, it showcases our fair city, although Baton Rouge is never mentioned, is it?
No, it's just anywhere USA.
Okay. Well, Sonny Cranch, good luck with Pinkville, and thanks for all you've done through the years. Appreciate you, man. Take care.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us in studio now is the political consultant who is... still in her 30s and killing it.
Still for one more year, Jim. One more year.
Just back from Paris. Before we get to Tim Walz, well, how about Mondo Duplantis?
Yeah, how about it, man? That was beautiful to watch, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he's doing it for Sweden, his mom's country. Both his mother and father were track athletes of significance at LSU. But this guy is a world record holder many times over, and he set another world record in the pole vault yesterday. And for those who think Joe Burrow or Paul Skeens or somebody else, Angel Reese, you pick them as the best LSU athlete, no, it is Mondo Duplantis. He is the GOAT. And and he is.
He certainly is.
He's got some time left, too. I think he'll keep going, and he may break his own record. And I love the fact that he's just getting better and better and better. And he's a guy who now is a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah,
people know who he is.
Having that sort of like sense of where your body is in the middle of the air is just superhuman. I have a good friend who's a sports writer that covered me in high school, and his daughter is a pole vaulter in college. And she was, you know, kind of talking to some folks I know just about how insane it is to watch him as someone who's trained to be a pole vaulter her entire mm-hmm. life. It, you know, how effortless it seems. Just the high level of skill, the genetics and the mindset. It's incredible, and I love seeing his success. He's such a nice person.
And you went to Paris, as we know. I did. We heard you on the phone.
It was the trip of a lifetime, Jim. It was really magical. I didn't have time to set a lot of expectations. I've been busy with work this summer, and I think it would have exceeded whatever I'd come up with in my mind if I would have tried to imagine how great it was going to be. It's just a really magical atmosphere, the Olympics, and of course Paris itself, City of Lights, and so romantic and lovely. Had a wonderful time, and now I'm back in lovely Louisiana.
There you go.
Yeah.
And now we have a governor chosen from Minnesota.
Yeah, Midwesterner.
Yeah.
You know I love to see that.
60 years old. He's born in the same year as Kamala Harris, 1964. Remember that year? And they're now the presidential and vice presidential candidates for the Democratic Party. He's from a state that the Democrats have not lost since 1972. So why was he chosen instead of Shapiro, who is from Pennsylvania and the most popular politician in a state that the Democrats have to have? Why was it Tim Walz instead of Josh Shapiro?
You know, I kind of see this pick as very much an Obama-Biden style pick. Somebody who complements what's already there but doesn't outshine it. And the math on Shapiro and Kelly and some others that had math drawbacks. Shapiro in particular, I think, would have put Vice President Harris in a position to have to talk about a Palestine-Israel conflict all the time. In a state that she can't afford to lose. And, you know, you've got Minnesota Midwesterner guy who can come along and kind of not have a stain or a slant on what's going on in the Middle East. And then, you know, I was a big Mark Kelly fan, but I think in the Senate, the numbers are too close for Democrats to risk taking a senator out of the Senate. So I think it's just downplaying what a great choice Governor Walz is, but I think just math-wise, and no offense to all the candidates, but of all the, you know, kind of middle-of-the-road white guys that she could have selected, he's the one that had the math.
Well, Tom on Bluebonnet makes a good point that if John Bel Edwards had been pro-choice and anti-gun, he might very well have been the nominee. He wouldn't bring Louisiana, but
I'm not sure what electoral votes he would really bring. And I think in a longer vetting process, a candidate like John Bel Edwards would have had a better chance because you'd have some time to get him out there and kind of show what he can do on television.
Solid as a rock.
He didn't have a divorce
like Shapiro did.
Yep.
And why that would be an issue with Donald Trump as the opponent is somewhat
suspicious. you've got a ticket now, Harris-Walz ticket, that if this ticket cannot beat a Trump-Vance ticket, I think we have some examinations to do as a nation when it comes to what our values really are. And maybe we need to be a little bit more honest about what our values really are if they can't win.
All right. We'll talk more. 877-217-5757. Another quarter hour with Mary Patricia Ray after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. So it's the Harris-Walz ticket for the Democrats. That'll be what will happen in Chicago later this month as the Democrats will leave the Windy City trying to keep the White House and keep Donald Trump from returning to the White House with J.D. Vance. Born in 1984, he just made 40 years old. So the Democrats have a nominee who will be 60 in October and a running mate who's 60, and the Republicans have a 78-year-old and a 40-year-old. So it's about the same as far as an average of about 60 years, which in the old days would be an old ticket for each. But now we were looking at the prospect of two 80-year-olds or one of them very close to 80 and one a bit above, but that didn't happen when Joe Biden got out. And it's hard to believe, Mary Patricia, that it's only been 23 days since all of this happened. And Kamala Harris has been moving on up, and she is now, according to Real Clear Politics, she is ahead of Donald Trump in what would be I hate the term, it shouldn't be called the popular vote, it's the vote. But she's ahead in the vote, but as you know, Democrats, because of the Electoral College, probably need to win by about 3% mm-hmm. to win the election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of people have talked about what a short vetting process she had to pick a vice president. But, you know, I mean, in reality, if you have what we would look at as a traditional vetting process, it's long, but you actually wait to make your pick until it's timely, until you can see what it will do in the polls and make some predictions. And they had plenty of data to make this selection. And I think that they've done what they need to do to get to that viewpoint, to get to that point of being able to see the 3 points they need to be 3 points ahead. And, you know, we got a long way till November, but I think this guy's going to do really good on TV. Governor Walz is great on television. He's even better in person. He's just a very authentic person. He's likable. And I think that ultimately Vice President Harris is still not polling as well as she will, especially among Black voters. And so there's definitely a pathway in the polls I'm seeing for her to be 3 points ahead. Whether she gets there or not, we'll have to wait and see. But she has the room to grow her numbers very clearly.
877-217-5757 for Mary Patricia Ray. Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Hello, Patrick.
Patrick.
Talk Louisiana.
Hey, so we don't know a lot about, I mean, she's not out there. It's almost like they're doing the same tactic they did with Joe Biden, where they keep Kamala in the basement. Why didn't she show up at the Black journalists event? I mean, Trump showed up. He was asked a racist question, so he gave a somewhat racist answer. I guess when you're asked a racist question, you talk about racism. But why didn't Kamala Harris show up to that event?
Well, you know, I go a lot of different places in Baton Rouge. I'm always struck lunchtime in Baton Rouge. Every restaurant that I walk into, Jim, that has televisions is on Fox News. And know you don't see on Fox News Kamala Harris. So it's kind of no wonder to me that people who subscribe to a more, you know, GOP viewpoint seem to think mm-hmm. that she's hiding out, that she's nowhere to be seen, mainly because she's not shown on the media outlets that they choose to view. I thought the event went very poorly for President Trump, and frankly, what a great strategy for her to not show up. Let him have the full stage to fail on.
She offered to do it by Zoom and was rejected, and I don't blame the Black journalists for doing that. But Trump did show up, as Woody Allen once said, 85% of success is showing up, but that's also showing up and not making an ass of yourself. And Trump probably did that by design. That wasn't his remarks. Weren't to the people in that audience. They were to the white bubbas who support him.
I think everybody won in that situation. You know, the Black Journalists Association wanted to appear to be having an open forum where he was invited. They won that. They checked that box. He showed up and talked to his base, and he checked that box. Kamala Harris avoided the entire disaster. She checked her box.
And that's the way politics is played. There are always ulterior motives, shall we say. But now Trump is saying he only wants to debate Harris if it's on Fox with a studio audience with Fox hosts moderating the debate. Harris says she'll show up for the debate that Trump agreed to on ABC with Joe Biden. Will they debate?
I am going to put my money on no. Right now, I think, you know, I could always change my mind later, but I think if the debate was supposed to be next week, for instance, I don't think it would happen. I think Trump ultimately is going to be the one who makes the decision, and he's inclined probably to not take the advice he's given. So I would, if I was advising President Trump and I wanted him to debate, I'd probably tell him not to. If I didn't want him to debate, I'd probably tell him to do it. And it's all going to be based on what they're seeing in polls and whether there's a need to or whether the risk reward is worth it for him. I do not think a debate will hurt her with her base. I think it can only help her with her base, and that's where she still has room to grow. So it's smart for Kamala Harris.
Well, let's see what the polls do. If Trump falls behind, he probably will debate. But right now, as I stated, I could see a replay of 2016 very easily in which Kamala Harris wins the overall vote and Donald Trump wins in the Electoral College. And it comes down to those three states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Now, if Harris can get North Carolina or Georgia or Arizona or Nevada, she doesn't need all three. But right now, she's behind in all of those states. So we will see. But presidential debates started in 1976 after a 16-year hiatus. because after Nixon got clobbered by Kennedy, he refused in 72 and in 68 to debate either George McGovern or Hubert Humphrey. And Lyndon Johnson in 1964 declined to debate Barry Goldwater because Goldwater was a better public speaker and would have probably hurt Johnson, who ended up winning 44 states. Nixon, as we know, won 49 states in 72, beat Humphrey in a close race, and if Humphrey had had a debate, he might have won, but he didn't. So debates sometimes do make a difference.
Sometimes, and I think in a modern age, what they really demonstrate to voters, whether they understand this is what is being demonstrated to them, is the ability to perform off the cuff, without a script, without a plan, you know, and to some degree, they're still scripted and practiced. But,
all right,
you know, voters get a look at how you perform when you don't have a million people helping you.
Here's Howlin' Monroe saying, will Vance and Walz debate?
I hope so. Man, I would sign up to, like, WWE, you know, cage match. And honestly, from the few interviews I've watched of Governor Walz over the last couple of days, I think he would do really well against Jay. And what I mean by that is not even in a biased sense. I think it would be a great debate, to watch, because I think you would see a big contrast. It'd actually be really helpful to voters. I think you'd really be able to see a difference between the two candidates, not just on policy, but on demeanor, and who wears eyeliner. And who
does JD wear eyeliner?
It sure looks like it to me lately on a lot of these interviews.
Looks like he's got some Ozempic too. He's lost some weight. He needed to lose some.
Well, you know, he has to do all of his interviews standing up now, so that people won't be looking at what he's sitting on. And that's where we are in American politics.
Well,
it's sad.
Optics often make a difference, but the Democrats.
There's nothing wrong with wearing eyeliner, by the way. I just think when you lie about it, it creates issues for you. When people confront you about things you've done that mm-hmm. maybe are weird, maybe they're not. When you pretend as though you haven't done those things, it
he's
makes you look
Marine,
delusional.
He's a Marine who wears eyeliner.
And hey, look, I have candidates who are powdered on television. You know, we take the shine off. We make sure they look mm-hmm. how they would look in real life on television. But if you're not wearing eyeliner on a daily basis and it's obvious that you're wearing it on TV... Maybe
okay.
you just like wearing
eyeliner. But independent of that, what about the cat lady thing? What about saying
I mean,
that,
how dumb to piss off white women in general when that's like who
from your
who
home
is gonna,
state and your home university.
Look, I'm not a cat person, but I know a lot of women who are.
And I'm a cat person.
And
I can bench press my weight.
The idea that my only value that I can add in society is whether or not I've had a child is not a positive talking point for a huge section of the likely voters that could make a difference in this election. Just dumb. Dumb.
You know, Trump is the first president, a listener notes. This is Holly in the Garden District who does not have a pet in modern time. He doesn't have, remember Clinton had socks? He had socks and he had a dog too. And yeah. Bush had a dog. And
it's very rare that we like politicians that have animals. It says something
about
them.
It says some humanity, yeah. I think. Yeah. But they do mess up the furniture sometimes.
Sure.
And Trump,
I have two big
Trump wouldn't want animals in Trump Tower, I don't think.
Well, he would definitely have someone who's paid to manage them. It's not he wouldn't want a dog for himself, I don't think.
All right. Well, you just said, and I didn't bite on it, but you go downtown, you see Fox News all over the place. In our building, by the way, which used to be owned by another gentleman back in the day when that guy owned it, out in the lobby, when it was still part of the clerk of court's office, they would have people voting, and they would have Fox News
on the
screen. And I remember when Landrieu ran against Cassidy, there's Fox News attacking Landrieu as people going in to vote. I think she should have challenged the election, Mary
yeah.
Patricia.
Well, and look, I'm not even saying I have anything against Fox News. I just it's a choice, and when you pick what you're going to consume, you have to acknowledge that you've selected it to reinforce your own biases and be aware. Just be aware of that. And if that's what you want to do, hey, it's a free country. You can do it.
But Baton Rouge is a blue dot in a red sea. And Louisiana, I know people don't like to hear it, but it looks like Trump will win here for a third time. But he may not win the election, but it looks right now, 13 weeks out, it's going to be close.
I'm excited. I'm ready to do it.
Yeah, it's a great time to be an American, as Mike Wolf would say. And we're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.